right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've got a really exciting and really powerful show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Samba Gajigo, who's the co-director of a brilliant new documentary called Sembane. It's a documentary on the life and work of one of the most astounding artists to come out of Africa, to actually work in Africa, to tell the story of the African people because it had never been told before. And Samba is the co-director of the film Sembane, which is, as I said, it's an astounding new film. We'll be talking all about that. And joining us to talk about that with Samba is Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Kenyan writer and public intellectual, one of the most prolific and beloved writers in the world today, who was also part of that whole movement to stand up and reject the colonial cultures in Africa and to push out and build a whole new culture that reflected the African people and their fight for freedom. All right, that's the back end of the show. Opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring back to the show Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and Rise Up October. And Carl's joining us to talk about the outrageous stuff that's been going on over the last couple of days and the resistance movement against police murder. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure, man. And let's just jump into this because we've got limited time, but I really want to make sure people hear what you have to say about this. We have just been hit. Let's start out with, there were two things that happened. One was the racist assault on the protesters in Minneapolis, and the other was the outrageous, I mean, really outrageous thing that came down, the revealing of the video of the police murder of Laquan McDonald. Let's talk about Laquan first, because it really sort of focused some stuff up there. I mean, it's like everybody's talking about it. They're looking at it. And a lot of people are just like, it's like you put it in front of their face and people have now seen it and people are astounded. But there's still a question of like, let's look at what's actually going on there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, see, that's really important that people look at what's behind that, because you have a situation of a young man, obviously in some distress. A cop shows up, comes on the scene, and just starts shooting him. Not because of any provocation on the young man's part. He just starts shooting him and then continues to shoot him as he falls to the ground and continues to shoot him as he lay on the ground lifeless. And this is all caught on video. The authorities have the video right away, and they sit on it for more than a year, carrying out a so-called investigation, which was nothing but a cover-up. And the only reason that we're able to talk about this now is that someone found out about this, leaked the information to a journalist, who then went for a Freedom of Information Act report, and then into court to force the release of the video. And then all of a sudden, this cop gets indicted for murder and the video gets released. More than 1 year later. I mean, think about that. A murder caught on video, no provocation, no reasonable, justifiable reason for doing it. Still, the authorities take more than a year. And what they're really telling us is that our stance is that black people have no rights, that this white supremacist system is bound to respect. That's what this comes down to. Then when they release the video, they appeal for calm while the system, the same system that has exonerated cop after cop after cop, and in the case of Chicago, the same district attorney who has exonerated cop after cop, including cases where it was out in the open, revealed publicly that the cops lied about their report in the killings of unarmed, innocent people, the same district attorney who has presided over the exoneration of those cops is the one that people should rely on to prosecute this killer cop. But we are told we should be calm.
Carl, tell me this, man, because, you know, as I'm listening to this, it's really important because, and I want to turn up the heat a little bit on this, because the point that you made about they've had this video for a year, they've had it, they've watched it, they know it's there, they had all of this stuff that was out there, and they sat there, and not only did they just have the thing and decide not to do anything about it, the cop was still working. He was taken off the street and put in a comfy little desk job somewhere in a station, but they knew all this, and they weren't doing a damn thing about it. It wasn't until exactly what you're saying. And see, here's the thing. exactly what you're saying, where people actually found out about it and they said, hey, there's this video. And then it has to come out. They have to, you know, and the district attorney starts, you know, tries to act like, well, before they somebody announces this, I'm going to put it out and appear to be all, we're being forthright and open about what's happening. But this pig had been there for 13 months. Everybody knew about it. Rahm Emanuel, the former member of the Obama mob, was up in there who talked about, and he was the mayor. He knew it was there. None of them did a damn thing. When you look at that video, and it's so clear, a young man walking down the street, and this pig comes and shoots him 16 times. And if people hadn't found out about this video, nothing would have happened.
Exactly, because the report that was filed, the newspaper reports, the police reports, all allege that Laquan lunged at the cops and the cop had no choice but to defend himself by killing Laquan. See, and those are the magic words, I feared for my life, that cops know all they have to do is recite. And then they get off, no matter how horrific the murder is. And that's what was underway in this case. Just like if we look at the Walter Scott case in South Carolina, the black man who was shot in the back 6 times by a cop, that cop reported that Walter Scott had fought him over his taser, and he feared for his life, and he had no choice but to kill him. And that cover-up was underway before that video got released. But that was a video the cops didn't have. It was released by a person who just happened to be walking down the street and saw what was happening and was resourceful enough to film the murder. This is one they had from the beginning, and they were going to sit on it. They were going to stonewall. They were going to refuse to bring it out. And it's the whole system that was operating around this. I watched the news reports from back when the murder actually happened, and they all have this cop saying that the kid lunged at the cops and they had no choice. See, and what we're getting here, when we look into this, this cop also had at least 17 complaints for brutality and abusive behavior, complaints, some of which led to the city paying out hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements to the people who complained. But none of them were upheld by the internal police investigation procedure. They were all deemed as unjustified. So this cop abuses people, brutalizes people, hurls racist invective at people throughout his career. But still, he's got a badge and a gun and a license to kill, a license that he used to take out Laquan. And this really does bring us down to what is the role of the police. And this is something that Bob Avakian, leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaks to very clearly in his book, Basics. And that is that the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people, but to protect and serve the system that rules over the people. And that's what's being brought out into the open in this case, in the Minneapolis case, and in cases all across the country. And it is a lesson that people need to learn and act on.
Let's talk about Minneapolis for a minute, because that's actually very important that you brought that up in conjunction with this, because you're looking at this thing, you see this video, the outrage of the people, the thousands of people that are coming out to protest this all over the country. Then you see Minneapolis, and they're just bald-faced. I mean, here are these white yahoos coming out, these racist yahoos coming out, and just start shooting at black people, and they shoot 5 black men. Let's talk about that. What's happened?
What's going on in Minneapolis? And just let people know, I've issued statements on both Minneapolis and Chicago, and those statements are accessible at the website revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And like you said, in Minneapolis, there was an ongoing protest of people outside of a police precinct where the cops who had murdered Jamar Clark about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago now, they had been protesting continuously for like about a week and a half. And white supremacists had come down to the encampment of a protest site that they had and threatened them. They'd also issued threats online. And then at one particular time, actually it was Monday, these white supremacists came down and they were masked. And this is when they pulled out guns and shot at the protesters and shot five of them. All of them survived. And these white supremacists fled the scene. The cops were called. The cops came to the scene, and as opposed to looking for the white supremacist who had shot people who were nonviolently demonstrating, they maced the demonstrators. That was their response to this racist vigilante outrage, which is really attempted murder, because even though they didn't succeed in murdering people, they did shoot people. And when you're shooting people, you're trying to kill them. So that was the response of the authorities, to mace the demonstrators. One of the cops said to the demonstrators, "This is what you all wanted." See, and this raises again the history and the role of the police in this society, because the police in this society have a long history of collaborating with these kinds of racist assaults where they didn't carry them out themselves. You know, where racist vigilantes, whether they are openly Ku Klux Klan or whatever form they take, often these people collaborate with the police, are known to the police, and in some cases are even off-duty cops. I don't know that that's the case in this case, but the way the police responded to this, you have the same, you know, working at the same goal from two sides, the official side of the police and the unofficial side of these racist vigilantes, all of them acting to suppress black people, and especially black people who are standing up and fighting against the oppression of black people. Now, one thing that's very important to note and underscore in the case of what happened in Minneapolis is that the protests of the murder of Jamar Clark, the protesters were not just black people. There were people of different races and nationalities involved. And the protest got larger after this racist assault. So as opposed to people being intimidated and backing away, they came out with even more strength, more defiance, and more determination. And this is very important because the authorities have doubled down on unleashing their cops to brutalize and murder people and exonerating them when they do. These racist vigilantes coming into the scene represents another upping of the ante. And like Cornel West and I said when we decided to issue the call for Rise Up October, what's needed is the resistance movement to step up its activity, to grow in size and to become more defiant and more determined to act to stop it. And like I've been saying from way back decades ago when I co-founded the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, I said resistance was necessary to beat back these attacks, but it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end them once and for all. And that's a message that I will repeat today, because things should not be this way. It should not be the case that those who are sworn to protect and serve brutalize and murder the people they're supposed to be protecting and serving. That should not be the case, but it's going to take a revolution, getting rid of this system and bringing a whole different way for people to live into being, to end that horror and all the other horrors that this system enforces on people, the attacks on our immigrant sisters and brothers, the violence and degradation against women, the wars for empire, and all the rest.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, real quick. Basically, you know, how can people get in touch with you, in touch with the movement?
To get in touch with the movement, go to the websites, two websites, revcom.us. That's the website of Revolution Newspaper. And they can find my statements on this. They can also find more of the stance that Bob Avakian takes on the question of police murder and all the other horrors of this system, and on the new world that revolution could bring into being. People should also go to the website stopmassincarceration.net, and they can connect there with a nationwide movement that is fighting to stop the slow genocide of mass incarceration and police terror.
And the question is posed very sharply for all of you all out there now, all right? The question is posed very sharply. You've seen what's going on. You know what's going on. So now, which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
That's right. All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, talk to you again soon, man. Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, as well as Rise Up October. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk about a brilliant new documentary, Zembane. All right, so stay tuned. Welcome back, and that is Senegal to Senatobia by Otha Turner. All right, Ousmane Sembène has been called the father of African cinema. He's a brilliant, brilliant artist. He was a brilliant artist. And there's a brand new documentary out called Sembène. It tells the story of Ousmane Sembène, the novelist, filmmaker who fought a lifelong battle to give African stories to Africans. And he was part of a whole post-colonial artistic movement that rejected the dominance of the colonizers' culture and insisted on telling their own stories in their own language. Joining us to talk about this today are two people who, in many ways, embody exactly that. First joining us is Samba Gajigo. And I, you know, Samba, I had practiced that all night long, all right? Samba Gajigo. All right, and Samba is the co-director of Sembène. And Samba, I have to tell you, a brilliant film, man. I've watched it 3 times now. I'm like, you know, including the one time at Sundance when we first met, and it was just, it doesn't lose any of its power. And also joining us is Gugi Watthiongo, Kenyan writer and public intellectual, and one of the most beloved writers in the world, all right? And he's going to be all modest about that, but you actually are, and your work has been extremely important for people trying to stand up against colonial culture and imperial culture being imposed on them and setting a whole different narrative for people's lives. Gugi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you're going to have to get right up on the mic, okay?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh.
All right.
Okay,
Samba, let's jump into this with you. You know, let me play the trailer from the film just for a couple seconds there, however long it is, and we'll play that and people can get a sense of what the film's about, all right?
All right.
Some say we are made of flesh and blood. I believe we are made of stories. So, let me tell you a story of the dog walker who taught himself how to make movies and invented a cinema for a new Africa. Used his camera to fight corruption and injustice and imagine a better world. Let me tell you the story of the father of African cinema who used his camera as a weapon and gave us our stories back. I will tell you the true story of Sembène. I will not let his story be forgotten.
All right, welcome back. Samba Gajigo, the co-director of Sembène. Samba, tell us, what made you feel compelled? I mean, it's clear from your voice in the trailer, but let's talk about it a little bit more deeply. What made you feel compelled to actually, one, find Sembène when you found him, and two, to make yourself actually the sort of protector, but also the person who's bringing that work back into the world after Simbane's death. What compelled you to make this film?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I think in a nutshell, I'm telling Simbane's story, but also the story I'm telling is about my own life experience. As an African born after World War II, and who grew up at a time still when our educational system was dominated by French textbooks, I was really on the brink of drowning culturally because I had absorbed all these French stories, which a priori could have been a source of wealth if those stories did not suppress or repress my own people's stories. And Simbane's own stories rescued me from that cultural drowning. So when I'm telling Simbane's story, it's just because I feel all Africans, all black people, all people, as another African intellectual would say, all those who have the color of oppression need to know that our oppression in Africa, at least, stems not only from the use of guns, from the taking of our land, but also from the taking of our stories. So I just wanted, in telling the story, for all the oppressed people to know how important storytelling will also be very important for our liberation. So that's basically the reason why I did it. It's not just my work on Simbane is not just a scholarly work. It is a scholarly work, but it's also a political, it is a militant work.
You know, it's very interesting because when you bring people first into Simbane's house and you have to, you know, basically you have to, you know, just push your way in through, even though you had the keys and whatnot, and you get in there. And it's not just, you know, you might expect, okay, Simbane died in, what, 2007? And, you know, it's like you're looking at this and you're saying, okay, it's been a long time, it's been locked up. But then what you see, and this was really heartbreaking, what you see is the damage that time and the locked doors had done to the books, but also because Simbane was also, he was a prolific writer. And you look at this, you know, the life of his mind in exploring broadly all of the different cultures in society and, you know, and then concentrating in his own work on the culture of African people in Senegal and more broadly. Think about this, though. That was heartbreaking to see those cans, the cans that are usually protecting the films, and Simbane's personal copies of his films, how they were rusted out, and so I imagine a lot of the films were damaged. That was heartbreaking, and it also brought to mind the real necessity of one, well, it brought to mind the reality of they were going to, you know, the system sort of in the way it works in general, not saying that somebody said, okay, fine, we're just going to squash him, although he had enough of that in his life facing down authorities and other people for the films that he made and what he said. But there was this sort of way to shut him down by just everything closed after he died. You go in there, you find this, and you decided to tell his story in your own way, in your own film. Let's talk about the impact of you finding those films in that shape.
Yes, Simbane's work, those kinds of his films, his books, his manuscripts, his letters, I consider them as really our collective memory. And to see the dilapidated state of his house after his death, mostly at a time when, half a century after independence, the African landscape is still littered with monuments and names of the very people who subjugated us. That it's just something I could not fathom. I could not understand how the work of someone who aimed at galvanizing us, at uplifting us, would be a wasteland. I could not put it, I cannot even put it in name, actually. The images we showed, my co-directors and I, there is more to it. But unfortunately, those are the limitations of cinema. You have very limited space, you have very limited time. But we wanted to give our viewers a sample of what destiny, of what situation our creative artists are faced with. We have leaders, unfortunately, who do not understand. Actually, I think they do understand, but they are part of a system that continues the oppression of the African people. And that oppression also includes erasing from our collective memory the most significant men and women who are actually fighting for our liberation. That's Simbane's house is a metaphor of the current situation, cultural situation of Africa. Again, as I said, we erect memory, we erect monuments for people who oppressed us, but we are unable to see the value of the work of people who are trying to liberate us. So it is not just Sembeni, it is Chinua Achebe, it is Wole Soyinka, it is Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and you name it. It is Aminata Sofale, it is Mariamaba, all those cultural workers who devoted their life and that militancy to liberating the African people. And by the way, the film is dedicated to all the militants of African cause and of also the cause of all the African diaspora around the world.
Now, when I saw the film at Sundance, I know that one of the things that you and the other and your co-director made a big point of is when Sembeni wrote his first novel, did he write that in Wolof or did he write that in French?
By the way, I take this opportunity also to acknowledge participation of really partnership of Jason Silverman, the co-director, and our fantastic editor, Ricardo Acosta, and all the people who believed in us and who accompanied us, supported us for 7 years. But to answer your question, Sembeni wrote his first novel in 1956, at a time when he was a dock worker in Marseille. He is self-taught. He taught himself how to read. He could hardly speak any French. But he reinvented himself and wrote that novel, unfortunately, in French. He aimed at speaking to the African people, but he wrote the book in a Western language, which Africans could not understand. That's actually one of the reasons why, after independence in 1960, Sembeni turned to cinema and started making films in Wolof. And the first film he made in Wolof goes back to 1968. It is called Mandabi, subtitled in English, and the title in English is The Money Order. Mm-hmm. So Sembeni's itinerary is very, very important. It takes us from the use of colonial languages to the liberating use of African languages.
Now, joining us, in addition to Samba, we have a very special guest in studio, Gugi Wa Thiong'o. Now, Gugi, you teach at Irvine, you've done all this, you taught at NYU, but you're known throughout the world and loved throughout the world as a novelist. And you're also known for your work in critical theory and really dealing with a lot of the questions that Sembeni was actually wrestling with as well, including the fact that when you first worked, one of the problems that you came up against was if you were going to write in English, the vast majority of the people you wanted to reach couldn't read it. Let's talk about that contradiction. Well, first, what did you think of the film? And then we'll talk about that contradiction.
Oh, the film was... I saw it last night, actually. And it's really, you know, it's great. It's a great narrative. There's clarity of issues, clarity of Samba's relationship to Sembeni, Sembeni's relationship to African history, Sembeni's relationship to art, politics, and particularly the art, you know, of the cinema. The framing was great. The opening scenes are very captivating, as well as the ending. But every step of the way that narrative is really... Oh, man, I don't know how Maestro Samba was able to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
But he did it. So, yeah, it was really great. Talking of Sembeni, let me say, yes, I teach, you know, I'm a distinguished professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Irvine, and I've been teaching there for the last 12 years, I believe, and before that, NYU, and then Yale, and I can tell you, and then before that, in Africa, and in all those places, Africa, Yale, Northwestern, you know, Amherst, Holyoke, if I might say so, in all my courses on African or post-colonial literatures, Sembeni is always there, particularly one of the books actually mentioned in the film, God's Bits of Wood. So Sembeni has been very, very important in my teaching and organization and approaches to the teaching of African and post-colonial literatures and theory. Yeah, but he's also been important in my own life. I felt, you know, he's always been a kindred spirit. And wherever we met, although I didn't speak French that well, his English was better than my French, and my Wolof was non-existent, and his Gikuyu was zero. But somehow or other, through body language and everything else, you know, we were able to communicate, and I think we always felt that we were kind of kindred in the spirits, yeah.
It's interesting, too, though, because you both were responding to the same problem in a certain sense, you know, where we're actually, I mean, with Sembene, and I think with you, too, you know, you were broadly read, you were widely read, in, you know, in terms of your own experience, you read a lot. You weren't somebody who just sort of like backed off and didn't engage with the art and literature of the times, but you also ran up against a contradiction where it wasn't enough for you because the expressions of your people, it wasn't there. And with Sembene, the same thing happened with him, where he talks about in the film, he talks about how he's in Marseille, he's in Europe, and he finds art. He's listening to Mozart, which he wouldn't have been doing in Senegal. And he finds other forms of art. He finds painters. He finds all these things going on. But at the same time, both of you confronted this thing that while the art, the engagement with art and being able to express yourselves artistically was really important, at the same time, you both felt a need to be able to deal with that contradiction where you wanted to tell the stories of your people. Because as he said, as Sembene said, and Samba, I think you point this out in the film, he said, if Africans do not tell their own stories, Africa will soon disappear.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It is actually important in the case of Sembene, in his books and as well as his comments, actually, and even what emerges in the documentary, that he is and has never been against other influences, other cultures, he acknowledges them. But the question is, from what base, right, do you connect with the world? And what he realized, and I did, quite frankly, is that when you write in English or French and so on, whether by definition, the very fact that English is spoken by only about 5% of African people in any one country, French the same, Portuguese the same. It means that when you write in English or French, you are literally, by definition, excluding 90% of the population. And not just any population, you are excluding the social majority. You are excluding working people, farming people, people who have not been to universities and so on. So when you write in English or French, you are really literally addressing the elite of your own country as well as the elite of other countries, at least those who are able to read and speak, say, European languages. So the question you have as a writer, and I'm sure this is a question which he faced as well, is if you want to connect with African people at the level of those below the social elite, you really have no choice. You have to use the language and the languages that they speak. Of course, there are contradictions. There are very many African languages in any one African country. But I'd rather face the contradictions and find solutions rather than avoiding the issue altogether. And the result for Africa is disastrous. It means that the entire intellectual production by African elite, funded by our own national resources and everything, that entire intellectual production is in languages that make sure that knowledge is not accessible to the majority of African people who, through their taxes anyway, pay for the information, right? But they can't access it. It's not accessible to them. So what Sembene did with film was very, very important to me. He made a statement that you can make a film with characters speaking Wolof, and it can be accessible to others, you know, through whatever other means that other language films are accessible to other people of other cultures, yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Samba Gajigo, who's the co-director of the film Sembane. And folks, really a very powerful film. I can't say it enough times, and so you're going to get tired of hearing it, but I'm going to say it until you fill the theater. It's just an incredibly important film. Actually, Samba is also the biographer of Sembane, and he also is a professor of African Studies and French at Mount Holyoke. And he's got a really great film. And you've just been listening to Gugi Wathiongo, who's joining us in studio. Gugi's a Kenyan novelist, writer, and a professor at UC Irvine. He's one of the most prolific writers in the world, and I read everything he writes, okay? If he writes me a note, I read it 10 times, okay? I'm just addicted to his work. There you go. So anyway.
Thank you.
Sure. Samba, let's talk about this, because Gugi was talking about the point about the African languages and the need to actually say something, you know, to start writing the languages of the people in the country. And I remember in the film, there was a point where one of the books had a book in Wolof, and it was the first time that that phrase had ever appeared on a book in Senegal and or anywhere in the world, frankly. And, you know, Gugi, you had, both of you had the same experience at a certain point where you had this of needing to find the ways to actually reach the people, but there was also a contradiction that people ran up against, which was another big problem in a lot of African countries is illiteracy, where people can't read. You handled it one way, Gugi, yourself, and we'll get to you in a minute about how you handled that. But I wanted to ask you, Samba, because that's one of the things that seemed to really propel Sembane towards making films. Can we talk about that a little?
Yes, the book you refer to, actually, I mentioned it earlier, and Ngugi also mentioned, which is Guts, Bits of Wood, the English translation. The French title is Les Bouts de Bois de Dieu. And for the first time in 1974, I was in high school, I saw a book that had a subtitle in or translation or title in Wolof, Banti Mam Yal. That was really, for me, it was some kind of revelation. It was a mental fracture for me. And more than the title itself, for the first time in that book, which, by the way, chronicles 1947 strike of railroad workers in West Africa, which Sembane said actually was his way to demonstrate that the only way forward to African unity cannot be through the pigmentation of our skin. It is not through our blackness. It is through our class position. The African proletariat can unite on the base of their class position, but we cannot build African unity based only on the color of our skin. And that is a monumental book. And for the first time, actually, I saw in a book in which the main characters were Africans, but more than that, they had agency. For the first time, I read a book in which black characters won. Not only that, did they initiate a historical event, which was to initiate a strike, but they won. Before that, all the movies I saw, all the stories I read, black people were always losers when they were not just part of the environment, part of the decor. And I think that's what also, as Ngugi was saying, I think Sembane's pioneering work, and I think, again, that's an expression I'm going to borrow from Ngugi, is to use a language of people's real life experience. When you read a textbook in which they're talking about the snow of the French Alps, and you are in Senegal, you are completely disconnected, not only linguistically, but even the substance, the subject matter in which you are learning. So Ngugi and Sembane, Boubacar Boris Diop, and other African writers who write in African languages, again, to borrow Sembane's, Ngugi's expression, it is a prerequisite for, quote, decolonizing our minds. Because the colonization is not, as I said, or Edward Said has repeated, it is not the taking of our land. Mm-hmm. It is the taking away of our languages and of our stories.
Yeah, really, our mind.
Yeah. Our minds, our stories. Mm-hmm. Right now, at the time when we speak, we get most of our news about other African countries through the European capitals. Our elite does not listen to our local radios. No, they listen to the BBC. They listen to Radio France International. They don't watch our own TV channels. No, again, they are watching only. They get information about their own people through news media that are broadcast from abroad. And that, I think it is that cycle that Ngugi, Semben and others are trying to break. And actually, with some measure of success, because when you go now, I know less about East Africa, but I know in West Africa you have a lot of private radios that broadcast in African languages. Mm-hmm. And I think that pioneering work was done first by Semben and then by Ngugi and others and the new generations. I think the people who are really behind are really those who are termed our elite, our leaders. They are not leading anything because they live in the dark.
And actually, it's really interesting because one of the things you do very well in this film is the excerpts from Sembane's films that you show, including the one where it's just a complete mockery of the people, the rulers, the functionaries who came to power and at a certain point, and then how they're really bought off by the various imperial powers. And it was just such a mind-blowing. He's very sharp and very funny in ways, in the way that he portrayed these people. I want to get back to this, though. And Gugi, you can speak to this as well. You know, this point of it was not – they come at you in a lot of different ways because on the one hand, intellectuals who decide to write, they decide to make films. It's not easy to do that when you're in a country like, you know, you're in a country in Africa. It's not easy to do. It's not easy to do anywhere. But when you have a situation where actually, as you guys are saying, everything was geared towards supporting in one way or another the ruling colonial or post-colonial regimes and the imperial powers behind them and allowing the continuing rape of the entire continent. You're looking at this and you guys set out, you, Sembane, you set out to actually tell the story of Africa in African voices, for people to actually be able to tell their own story. You confronted different contradictions in there. You had to resolve the contradiction of people not having access because they couldn't read. You solved it in many other ways, including things that you didn't even know about, as I remember, where people were reading them in factories to other people in bars at night or on buses and trains. But you also moved to the theater somewhat. But one of the things that happens in all this is every step you try to make forward, and I think Sembane confronted this as well, every step you tried to make forward, and this is brought out in the film, it was really difficult because everything is cut off from you. There is no, like for instance with Sembane in film, there was no structure for filmmakers, for African filmmakers. There were no actors. There was very little equipment. There was no funding. All of these things that you had to go up against, and including with you, Gugi, when you decided to write in Kikuyu, you faced a certain question of distribution, getting it out there, getting it produced, all of these other things. How do you see that
First of all, let me say that the question of languages and cultures and mind, they are not simply peripheral to the totality of the struggles of, say, African peoples or any peoples anywhere. Quite quickly is this. The position is Africa is the biggest continent in the world. It can contain within itself the whole of North America, South America, the whole of Europe, China, and India, and leave room for New Zealand, I think. You know, Australia is the only continent who does not fit into Africa, right? It follows from this that Africa has the biggest, largest amount of resources. And Africa, since the dawn of capitalism, Africa has been the eternal donor to the West, contribute to the future, you know, of the West. In a summary, this is what I broadly speaking, without simplifying, this I say this: Europe gave Africa the resources of their accents. Right? Africa gave Europe access to the resources of the continent. And in a summary, that has been the problem. We have their accents, French, Portuguese, or English, and they have our resources, right? So you get this contradiction where the richest continent in the world is literally also the poorest. How does this come about? Why don't we see this as African people? This is where the question of the mind and languages and cultures come in. Because until we are able to see ourselves that we are really the masters of Africa and the resources of Africa are really ours to make things with and exchange accordingly on a fair basis, you know, we shall always remain, we shall always continue to contribute to the future of the West and other countries, right? Instead of contributing to the future of Africa. And I think what Ben is saying, I'm saying that struggle to contribute, to make our resources contribute to the future of the continent has begun with decolonizing our minds through language and through opening this communication with the people. But the problem, there are forces within Africa and outside Africa who do not want this to happen, right? And they're horrified when African people talk about their languages and so on, or when they talk about initiatives coming from the continent, right? When they talk about African unity, like Nkrumah used to talk about African unity, he was ridiculed. Now Europe is doing what Africa was saying they would do. So, right? So this is really, we had to, African people had to see this, you know, we had to free our minds so as to see the reality of what is going on at the level of economics and political manipulation.
Samba, I want to ask you a question about this because we're running up on our time, but we have about maybe a little bit more, a little bit less than 10 minutes left, but I want to actually make sure that we can talk about some of this because the films that you feature in the documentary, I mean, and you really have some excellent clips from these films that really give you a sense of Sembene's work. And they're very, very controversial. You know, they're really, and there's two things about them. One is there's no holds barred when you're going up against what Sembene saw as the problem, whether it be religion and in particular the one, what was the film in Enchedo where he talked about Islam, and it was a very heavy, you know, it was limited in its run in the country and in other places. And I read somewhere that Sembene had actually gone out to the theaters with a leaflet when it was censored and parts were removed from the film. He went out with a leaflet describing the scenes that were moved, that were removed. But there was the trilogy that he wrote that across the board just really hit at all of these things. And then there was the final film that he did, which I am still stunned by. I'm really stunned by it. And I don't know that I'll pronounce it correctly. Is it Mulade?
It's Mulade. Shot Mulade. In 2002 in Burkina Faso.
Okay, it was one of the most powerful. I mean, that what you brought from that, and I kept thinking, the man was 80 years old when he made this film. And
82,
okay. Oh, so he wasn't a young whippersnapper anymore.
Well, he was a young man.
But the point is that it was an incredibly powerful film that he gave his all to do, and the commitment. And I think, Googie, this is something that you actually feel yourself as well from the years that we've known each other. You're speaking, you're not only speaking, you know, in the language of the people, speaking to the people, you're also speaking to oppressed people worldwide in a certain sense of making some things in terms of human, when, you know, there's a point I think that Sembene also talked about returning the humanity that had been stolen from African people. And in a way that requires actually everybody in the world has to actually, you know, recognize that, but that involves actually their own, recognizing their own humanity as well, you know? And so, Samba, I wanted to ask you about that last film, because that was an extremely powerful, and it was so much what Sembene was about in terms of just poking the eyes of the oppressors, of standing up and fearlessly doing some things and taking a lot of heat for things that he did in relation to it, but really looking to make that. And I don't know if he knew it was going to be his final film or not. I mean, I know you said he was having, in the documentary, you talked about how he was having eye problems. He couldn't see that well. And he was sleeping at night with IVs going into feeding him nutrients all night long so he could actually keep making the film, keep working. But that was such a powerful and such amazing film that to this day, carries with it so much import in the world as a whole, including right here and what's happening to women here in this country on a whole other level in relation to abortion and all these other things. But that whole thing around the mutilation, the genital mutilation of women, really very a very important film, I thought.
Yeah, what is interesting about Mulade, it is, as you mentioned, it was his last film, which he started shooting in 2002 in Burkina Faso. For the first, we mentioned already Wolof. He did films in Wolof. his films in Jola. Now let's not make a mistake. There is Jola, which is spoken in southern Senegal, and then you have Jula, J-U-L-A, which is spoken in northern Côte d'Ivoire. It is spoken in Burkina Faso. It is a variation of the Bambara spoken in Mali and the Mandinka that is spoken in Guinea. This was the first time Sembène left Senegal to go make a film in a different country. It took him years for the scouting to find the exact location of the film, which is very, very symbolic. It is halfway between Burkina Faso, southern Burkina Faso, northern Côte d'Ivoire, and eastern Mali, symbolic of the African Union, which our leadership failed to accomplish since Addis Ababa in 1963. And then the film was, the cast is from Burkina Faso, is from Mali, is from Côte d'Ivoire. The set designer is from Benin. You have some Senegalese technicians and you have some French technicians. And the film was edited in Morocco. I mean, it's at 82 years old. And I saw Sembène faint twice on the set. And when I suggested to him to take a break, and his answer, I actually put that in the documentary, his answer was, I will have enough time to rest after I die. We need to make this film. Which means, for Sembène, those images are what I would call a value, or what French philosopher Albert Camus would call a value, something that transcends in importance our own lives. And to come back to the subject matter of Mola, again, it's when they showed the film for the first time at the Cannes Film Festival in 2004, I think it was, some commentators said it was the most youthful film Sembène had made by its vibrancy and by its energy. It is the most youthful film Sembène made. And he was taking on one of the most significant, one of the most horrific human rights violations in Africa, which is about female genital mutilations, which, according to the research we made, is still practiced in 38 countries out of the 54 that form the African continent. And it was of move. Yes, you are absolutely right. I mean, it's one of the, maybe the most beautiful also artistically films that Sembène also made. Because when people asked him, why the setting where you did it, the film, he said, it is, I did not want to give a setting that reflects the misery of Africa we see in the Western media. I did not want dust. I did not want decay. I wanted green, lush green, that would project the beauty of Africa. So the political content of it, the craftsmanship of it, and the setting of it were all symbolic of Sembène's vision of the Africa of the Africa of tomorrow. Yes, Sembène. I think Sembène has gone through a lot of ordeal. I mean, Ngugi has not mentioned this. There are some stories you tell in Africa, they take you directly to jail. Sembène has never been jailed, but his film have been suppressed. You refer to Khala, where he's mocking our elite that hijacked independence right at the moment of independence. You talked about Cheddo, about Islam, which was banned in Senegal. There is a 1971 film he made, which is Emitai, which was also banned. All of Sembène's work went either through banning or it went through censorship. Ngugi can tell you first experience that there are some plays or some poems you cannot write or could not write in Africa. They take you directly to jail.
Ngugi also had the experience of being probably the only African writer to ever have one of the characters in his novel being sought for by the government to arrest them. So it was kind of Matagari, yeah?
Yeah. Ngugi.
Yeah. We have about maybe 50 seconds for you to make any closing comments you want to make.
Let me just say this. First of all, thank you very much, Samba, for making this documentary. Really, I can't overpraise it enough, you know, because of very clarity and presenting a story of Sembène in which he comes alive, you know, as a writer, as a filmmaker, in his relation to you, then therefore to the younger generation, in relation to Africa as a whole, and in relation to humanity as a whole. Because remember, while Sembène was a particularist in the sense that he believed in Africa and so on, you know. But he didn't see Africa in isolation. We have to make this very clear. He did not see Africa in isolation. He had to see it in the context of the world. And while he was very concerned with Africanity and self, but he didn't think that every single custom in Africa was pure and, you know, and so on. That's why this last film is also important, when he says that there are some customs which, if they have outlived their purposes, you know, they become a hindrance, whether they originate from Africa or from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Samba, you have any in about 10 or 15 seconds? Anything you want to say real quick?
Well, I think I can just, I don't need to repeat what Google mm-hmm. said. I concur, but just to repeat what we have in the film, we Africans who are not alone in the world, but we should be our own sun. Mm-hmm. And if others don't see us in the dark, we should see ourselves.
All right, Samba, thank you very much. And I'm going to tell people right now, you got to go see this film, all right? Don't miss it, folks. This is a film that literally, it's one of those films that will change the way you think, change the way you walk through the world. Samba Gajigo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for Ngugi's endorsement of the film.
Yeah, and if you come out to L.A., definitely get in touch, and we'll do a whole big thing. We'll try and get you and Ngugi together and do a whole big panel and see what we can do around this, all right?
I cannot wait.
All right, Mr.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, Ngugi Wathiong'o.
Talk to you later.
Okay.
Okay, Ngugi Wathiong'o, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
We'll have lunch again real soon, okay?
Okay.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Samba Gajigo, the co-director of the film Sembane, and with Ngugi Wathiong'o, Kenyan writer and public intellectual. And we've been talking about the film Sembane, which is really, as I said, a killer film. We're going to go out now. We're going to take a real quick... Well, first off, I want to thank all of my... all the people working on the show today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and I want to thank especially, just fun working with her again, my engineer, Nadia Richardson. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now real quick with a Senegalese hip-hop band, all right? So check this one out.
Senegal, West Africa, Kansas City, Kyrgyz back.
Demonu fenn jeru ñu gal bëpp bi lañuy ragal fenn lañuy xoti taal deug mo ñi regal ñokay matal duñu imposer regal duñu tapet di sakket ci net di té fu mu takké ñu tourna seeni casquette té duñu parti di kekke jënd leen ci bëpp fu yéri di ra té ku ma traak nga fay raket duñu ndaw ñi ngeen di copté def leen ni cobay ñu tax bi lañuy opté
fenn na ngeen cobay
duñu nekk ci al topé
def seeni bagay
ku doxul dégg ñu stoppé tek la sur les rails bañ kat ngay ci séxle té dina ya xanaay
revolutionario siempre siempre hasta la muerte
no slack to feed them
lo que necesita la lucha lo hacemos para la gente
no slack to feed them
revolucionario siempre siempre hasta la muerte
no slack to feed them
lo que necesita la lucha lo hacemos para la gente
no slack to feed them
ko ayo won ñu wacc tan bi caste